Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, December 30th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, a hospital thanking the nurses, technicians, and the entire staff at Saratoga Hospital for the care they provide. Saratoga Hospital, people you trust, care you deserve, saratogahospital.org. Joining us this afternoon to discuss nutrition, eating, and exercise is Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom. She is the medical director of the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Medical Center. If you have a question, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, but the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Lindstrom and your calls coming up on Medical Monday right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. As we prepare to ring in 2020, some of you may have set exercise and healthy eating New Year's resolutions. If so, we have an expert in the studio ready to answer your questions on this Medical Monday. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is the medical director of the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Medical Center. She oversees the nutritional, psychological, and physical requirements of patients seeking surgical weight reduction. She is also the division chief of Albany Med's internal medicine and pediatrics practice, where she provides primary care to people of all ages. She has a special interest in clinical nutrition and obesity and has conducted clinical research on childhood obesity and has lectured extensively on obesity management and bariatric medicine. She earned her medical degree from the University of Rochester Medical Center. If you want to participate in today's discussion, give us a shout. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But that number, write it down, 800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Here comes the busy time for you, right?
Yeah, January 1, a lot of New Year's resolutions get kicked in. Although, honestly, there's a great, you could do that any time of year.
Right. But
January 1's the busy
that?
Time of
yes.
year. Right.
And how soon before people give up?
Oh, it was on the news the other day. They said most people give up on their resolutions for diet and exercise by January 12th.
I don't know what data source is,
but it was on the news the other day.
And one of your goals is to keep people going.
Correct.
Keep people at it. How do you do that?
Well, you know, people come to bariatrics and nutrition for various medical needs. Most of our patients actually don't go to surgery. They're really there for nutritional guidance, whether they have diabetes, heart disease, hypertension. I see children for childhood obesity as well. So again, the vast majority of our patients are not surgical patients. And I think it really depends on why the person's there. You know, for some people, they really want to try to get their diabetes under better control, which is a little different than maybe working necessarily just on weight loss. So it kind of depends on what outcome they're looking for. I think most people who come to see us obviously do want to see some weight loss as well. However, you can improve your cholesterol through diet without losing weight, and there's value in that.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in children especially, I see a lot of children with high cholesterol where medications may or may not be indicated, and so really dietary and lifestyle modification is key.
You know, when people go for bariatric surgery, and I've heard this, they oftentimes they have to lose weight before the surgery, and I would imagine that the goal is the same. Whether you're going for surgery or not, the goal for you is to get people to change their mindset.
Yeah. So in bariatric surgery in particular, one of the things that we tell people is we don't do brain surgery. So none of the surgeries are really a cure for obesity. You can fail virtually any of the weight loss surgeries if you don't follow the guidelines after. And it's a lot of hard work. It's not the easy way out by any means. It requires a lot of preparation. And the thing about going to weight loss surgery, what we really strive to do in our program is to make sure people are really ready when they choose to have surgery because, again, you want to maximize their chance of success.
And that's physically ready and mentally ready.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah.
And how do you get them mentally ready?
Well, they do have a psychological evaluation if they're seeking surgery. Many people come in with pre-existing psychological problems. Depression and anxiety are exceedingly common. Other medical psychological issues as well. And really, we rely on our psychological team to help us decide, you know, do they really understand what they're getting into? Are they really ready to move forward to make positive changes? And so we work with our team. It's really a collaborative effort.
Do you often find or ever find that those who are coming in for pre-surgery weight loss and nutrition guidance end up not needing the surgery?
Correct. So, you know, certainly lifestyle change is by far the safest thing to do. Every surgery, including something as quote unquote simple as having your appendix out, has risk. And it's the same thing with bariatric surgery. So if someone can do it with lifestyle, that's by far the best option. And we do have people who come in and it clicks with them for whatever reason. And we can't really take credit for it. We provide guidance, but we don't do it for them. So they're really the ones who are working hard to make the changes.
Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is our guest from the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Medical Center. You ready for a call or two?
Sure.
All right, let's take a couple before our first break. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Ryan in Warwick. Ryan, you're first.
Hi, doctor. I'm calling up to see your opinions on raw milk. We've been drinking raw milk for a couple of years. Family seems to tolerate it better than we do like traditional milk, you know, but I've heard other people say that there's some dangers with it, and I was curious if you've come across anything like that.
Well, unpasteurized milk, if that's what you're referring to, is not recommended.
Yes.
Yeah, there are some serious foodborne illnesses that can come from unpasteurized milk. Pasteurizing doesn't affect the nutritional value of the milk as much as it does is make it safe. One of the things about milk in the United States that people may not be aware of is that milk in the United States is fortified with vitamin D. So when you get milk out of a cow, there's no vitamin D in it. The only reason there's vitamin D in it is that we fortify it. Although vitamin D is in a lot of natural food and people tolerate that well, so it's unclear to me why that would be the case, but unpasteurized milk in general is not recommended.
Okay.
Thanks, Ryan. We appreciate the call. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is here, and we go to Amy in Queensbury. Amy, you're on.
Hi. I just had a quick question. I've been doing my spin classes for about 2 months now, just trying to counter the whole holiday calorie intake, and I find myself petering out, losing steam halfway through my classes. Is there anything or any kind of carbohydrate that I can eat before a really high intensity cardio workout that will get me through the entire workout without petering out?
So your instinct about the carbohydrate is right. That's going to be your most immediate form of energy during high-intensity training, which I would certainly consider spinning to fall in that category. Not all carbs are equal, which is true really of any food. There's obviously different quality for every category. But for carbohydrates, you want to choose, honestly, dairy is fine. One of the best things on the market out there is Muscle Milk, which is essentially just chocolate milk. Remember, all dairy has protein. Okay, you're vegan. So
yeah.
do you drink soy milk?
I do.
Okay, so soy milk actually, per 8 ounces, soy milk has more protein than regular milk. So 2% milk, whole milk, 1% milk, per 8 ounces has 8 grams of protein. Soy milk has 10 to 11 grams of protein. It actually has more calcium in it as well. So soy milk might be a nice option for you as opposed to regular dairy. Well, I mean, a glass to maybe 12 ounces should suffice. But part of it, too, is when you're doing spin, you have to make sure you're not getting dehydrated. That will affect your exercise performance as well.
And how soon before the class?
You don't want to be hurling while you're spinning.
Yeah,
right?
You're going to have to balance that out. I mean, listen, it takes time for food to leave the stomach and to ultimately reach the parts of the small intestine where digestion occurs. So to be honest with you, there's not a great answer for that other than raise instinct about not making yourself sick before going into spin class is probably very important.
Right.
Yes.
You know, you're probably just going to have to perform an experiment, to be frank, only because how people digest food in terms of how long it takes to leave the stomach is variable, actually. It's called gastric emptying. So you'd have to kind of see what works best for you.
All right, Amy, thanks a lot for the call and good luck. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Medical Monday today. We talk nutrition, psychology, physical stuff with Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom, who is the medical director of the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Medical Center. Quickly, let's go to Jim from Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Can omega-3 fatty acids dissolve a thrombus that's already formed?
There is no current clinical indication to use omega-3s for an active thrombus. There's multiple prescription medications that are on the market.
What's an active thrombus?
A blood clot.
Ah.
So a thrombus could be in various different places. Common ones that people are aware of are DVTs, deep vein thromboses. Those can occur in the legs. You'll hear about that after surgery or if someone takes a long flight or a long car drive.
Yeah.
Pulmonary emboli are the other ones that are more concerning, more life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no clinical indication at this time for omega-3s to be used to treat a thrombus.
All right, Jim, thanks for the call. Let's take a break here. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom of the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Med is here. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be back. Medical Monday on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is our guest, and she is with the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Medical Center. And once again, the number to call is 800-348-2551. A lot of talk about the raw diet. Is that a thing that I should be thinking about? Because I don't think about it at all.
Whenever someone tells me they're on a certain diet, I always ask them what that means. I had a patient once who came in who told me that she was vegetarian.
Yeah.
And so I asked her, well, tell me what you eat. And it included chicken. And so I had to state to her that you really are not eating vegetarian. So again, when someone tells me they're eating a particular diet, I always ask for clarification because there's a lot of misunderstanding. So the raw diet was one that was being touted for health in terms of it being essentially ultra unprocessed, meaning fruits and vegetables, raw, not cooked. So for instance, if you take an apple in its regular form, you know, when you chew it, it's crunchy, it's got fiber.
Yeah.
As soon as you start processing apples, like you make applesauce, the glycemic index will be a little higher because you've broken down some of the fiber. And then once it gets to juice, the glycemic index is extremely high.
Right.
So that's some of what the raw food diet was aiming at, was reducing the processing of food in its natural form, although it did get taken to the extreme in some areas where meats and whatnot were being recommended at relatively raw temperatures, which again gets back to the unpasteurized milk issue where you can get foodborne illness.
Explain to me, and we'll get right back to the calls, 800-348-2551. You mentioned the glycemic index. Explain to me this sort of transactional thing that goes on. You say, well, I had this, it has 24 carbs, but it's got a lot of fiber.
Right.
Why does the fiber negate the carbs?
So there's two ways to lower the glycemic index of a food. The glycemic index is basically how rapidly your blood sugar rise after eating a particular food. So, for instance, we're in the holiday season. Cookies and candies in general have high glycemic index
right.
because of the type of things they're made of. But in order to lower that, you can add fiber, which is what you're asking about. That lowers the glycemic index because it slows the processing of the sugar when the body digests it. The other way to lower the glycemic index of a food is to add protein to it. So those are two ways to lower the way the body metabolizes it so you don't get such a massive blood sugar spike. So this is, again, something that people with blood sugar problems like prediabetes or diabetes, if they go see a diabetic educator, that's some of the information that they learn about.
No, I understand that, but it seems to me that it's almost like a carbon reduction credit when a power company can just buy some more credits and make some more pollution. In other words, you have this fiber, and if I have tons of sugar in something, but it's got fiber, it's okay, even if I'm diabetic?
oh no, not by any means at all. Listen, I mean, the amount of sugar still matters. And listen, the message isn't that you can never have cookies or candy again, but the reality is in America, we get far too much sugar in our diet. And there's an epidemic. I mean, in adults, a third of adults are pre-diabetic and a third of adults are actually diabetic. And pre-diabetes is really the area where you worry because it gets missed quite frequently. People do not have symptoms. Even with overt type 2 diabetes, they may not have symptoms. And the reason to know about prediabetes is that through lifestyle change, you can basically stop the development of diabetes. Mm-hmm. That's the whole name of the game.
Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is our guest. It's Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the number. Leo is in Boston Spa. Hello, Leo.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for the doctor about use of a new drug. Well, not really new, but new for weight loss, Saxenda. I use it as a daily injectable. In like 7 weeks, I've had like tremendous success. But I don't really know how it works.
So Saxenda has been approved for several years now for weight loss. The dose of Saxenda for weight loss is actually double what it is for diabetes. Part of the reason where patients may have concerns about using that drug for weight loss is it is an injectable as opposed to a pill. There's many other pills on the market as well. And it basically alters the way your body metabolizes glucose so that you're essentially losing calories by not metabolizing that glucose. So that's why it helps with weight loss. The issue in the United States for the FDA, in order for a drug to be approved for weight loss, it only has to demonstrate 5% weight loss, which is pretty minimal. So if, say, you weigh 200 pounds, if there's a medication which causes 10-pound weight loss in you by FDA guidelines, it could be considered to be approved for a weight loss drug. We have weight loss medications going back to the 50s, although that was phentermine. It was not studied. It was approved. It's still on the market today. So it's a bit of the Wild West in terms of older medications versus newer medications. But you're right, Saxenda was one of the more recent ones that was approved.
Okay, so I don't know if it's because I've had such success that I'm paying far more attention to what I eat and working better with the drug, like... I've really, portion control has come into it immensely, and it's a lot easier for me to maintain smaller portions. Like, I crave green beans and winter squash and funny things that before were like too much work. So, yeah, I've just had good luck with it. I mean, it's a pretty safe drug as long as it's used, you know, within the guidelines.
Right. And no one would recommend a weight loss drug without counseling you on appropriate diet or exercise. That would really be somewhat irresponsible. You really do need to do both. So it sounds like you're on track.
All right, Leo, thanks for the call. Now, you mentioned this drug that was not approved in the 50s and is still in operation today. We have some data now. We have a good 60 years. It seems okay.
Phentermine was approved in 1959. And you have to understand, the FDA was sort of a different thing in the 50s, and they didn't have the controlled trials that they have now for weight loss drugs. Phentermine is actually now part of a second weight loss drug called Qsymia, which is phentermine in combination with Topamax. That was actually the first medication approved on the market in 2013 after the whole Fen-Phen debacle in the 90s where people were getting heart valve problems. So the FDA went from the 90s all the way up through 2013 without approving any new weight loss drugs. So in that respect, phentermine was studied as part of this combination with Topamax. Topamax is more widely known as a medication which can be used for migraine prophylaxis or for seizures. It's been on the market a very, very long time. But this particular combination got approved by the FDA in 2013.
And I missed this Fen-Phen thing. What happened in the 90s?
So in the 90s, there was a combination of phentermine and fenfluramine.
Are these both stimulants? Does the ene mean they're stimulants?
Not exactly. Phentermine is an appetite suppressant. That's the one that was approved in the 50s, although it doesn't work. As a sole agent, it's not as good as it is with the Topamax. Fenfluramine was a second agent which acted centrally in the brain to reduce basically your hunger. Unfortunately, the fenfluramine part had adverse effects on heart valves, and it got pulled off the market by the FDA. And there were people who needed to have heart surgery after having been on that medication. So the FDA was sort of paying more attention to drugs that came through for approval because of this really serious adverse side effect that came through.
Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is our guest from the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Medical Center. The number on this Medical Monday is 1-800-348-2551. Chuck in New Paltz. Chuck, you're on.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
Okay. So I wanted to ask the doctor if she knows about or refers anybody to Overeaters Anonymous when they come to her.
That's a great question. So in our program, when someone comes through, they have a 10-page form they fill out, which I know sounds a bit absurd. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking to someone about their nutrition, you really need to know their entire medical history, including medications. But we take a psychological intake as well, which includes an eating disorder questionnaire. We find a lot of disordered eating behavior that leads to weight gain, which doesn't necessarily meet DSM criteria, meaning the psychiatric criteria for eating disorders. So we do, in fact, refer patients out for this disordered eating behaviors, whether it's Overeaters Anonymous, which I have no problem with whatsoever, or if they need true psychological evaluation with psychology and or psychiatry. We do take that into account when we meet patients for the first time, whether they're going for surgery or not, because the reality is that disordered eating behavior makes it very difficult for someone to be successful with weight loss attempts.
What is disordered eating behavior?
There's a lot of them. So in the United States, people are very familiar with anorexia and bulimia. I think those are probably two that people hear about most commonly. However, the most common eating disorder in the United States is binge eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Now, it's normal to binge eat during holidays, right? On Thanksgiving, I would argue most Americans binge eat. Maybe on your birthday, a special occasion, you binge eat. But there are people who binge eat every day. They tend to have significant issues with their weight, morbid obesity, medical problems related to their weight. There is one medication on the market approved for binge eating behavior. It was approved by the FDA called Vyvanse. Vyvanse is better known as an ADHD medication. But the FDA put a specific clause on that, which was, while Vyvanse is approved for binge eating disorder, it is not approved for weight loss. And so you would ask yourself, well, why do we care if it makes binge eating better, but it doesn't cause weight loss? Why do we care?
Yeah.
Binge eating is associated with metabolic abnormalities, including things like fatty liver. And fatty liver is now the most common cause of chronic liver disease in the United States and can ultimately lead to cirrhosis. So that was part of the reason the FDA had approved Vyvanse.
Okay. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is our guest. Pat is in Delmar. Pat.
Hello. I'd like to know the significance of eating eggs and meat. I've been told that it's very bad for your cardiovascular system, and I don't really agree with that.
So all things in moderation. There's three diets which can be safely recommended. So regardless of whether or not you have heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, fatty liver, there's three diets which are universally considered safe. They include the Heart Association diet, the Mediterranean diet, and the DASH diet. DASH stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. It's very similar to Heart Association and Mediterranean, just has a focus on low sodium. Now, in all of those diets, red meat, chicken, lamb, egg yolks are actually on those diets, but in limited quantities, meaning no more than once to twice a week. Egg yolks in and of themselves actually have been vilified for quite some time and likely are not as bad as we thought. They do have a lot of vitamins, B12, vitamin D. If you're willing to pay for the higher quality egg, the farm-raised eggs, you can get higher omega-3 in the egg yolk itself. So, but still, moderation is key, probably no more than one to two a day. There is a caveat for male diabetics where excess egg yolks are linked to mortality. So that's the one caveat.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That's just exactly the way I feel, that I think some of this is nonsense where you can't eat meat and you can't eat egg yolks.
Yeah.
So that's good. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat. We appreciate the call. It's Medical Monday, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is our guest today on the program. And now to John and Fonda. John.
Good afternoon. Doctor, I wondered if, in your opinion, type 2 diabetes is curable.
So that's an excellent question. I'm actually glad you asked it, because in my world in nutrition, one of the things that people will hear is that weight loss surgery cures your diabetes. It doesn't actually cure your diabetes. It puts it into remission. So I would argue that once you're diabetic, you're always diabetic. It's really a matter of control. So, for instance, we have patients who, even just with aggressive lifestyle intervention, they may have been on metformin and glipizide or Saxenda, like the caller from before, prior to losing weight and following a healthy diet and exercise. And as their A1C improves, they come off their medications. You're still considered a diabetic. I would argue that you still need your yearly eye exam to look for retinopathy. Many diabetics, I mean, the vast majority, need to be on cholesterol medication, as diabetes is considered an equivalent to heart disease risk. So it's really a matter of, are you controlled? And you can be diet controlled, but you're still diabetic.
I see. I did refuse those medications, and I control it with diet and exercise, but there's no cure then. I'm always in danger of the retinal issues or possibility of gangrene in toes.
Well, it's a matter of so your A1C should be monitored, right? And the thing about A1C, and getting back to prediabetes, one of the risk factors for having prediabetes is age 45 and older. So it's not age 65. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that blood sugar metabolism starts to change at about 45. And so if you're diet controlled, that's by far the best possible option. That being said, your A1C still needs to be monitored. Now, at some point, if something happens and your A1C rises, I mean, you'll have to have a discussion with your provider about what to do next.
All right, John, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Joanne in Bethel. Joanne.
Yes, yes, doctor. I have two questions. The first is, what's your opinion on the Prolon diet, which is a intermittent fasting, a plant-based diet, if you have an opinion on that?
So it's been all over the news. Johns Hopkins, there was a physician who just published an article in New England Journal of Medicine. The terminology is always somewhat problematic. So again, this gets back to like when someone tells me they're vegetarian. So let's go over the terminology. Intermittent fasting, true intermittent fasting, means 2 days a week you don't eat anything. Then there is time-restricted feeding, which is something that you may see celebrities talk about, where they only eat in an eight-hour window during the day. That's time-restricted feeding. It is not intermittent fasting. There's a modified intermittent fasting, which gained popularity several years ago. It was a book called The 5-2 Method, where instead of 2 days a week of not eating anything at all, you only ate 25% of your calories, which for most people was like 500 calories a day. And then the other 5 days you ate whatever you want. So the main problem with these various diets right now is that for human data, it's not robust. Although I will tell you, Johns Hopkins, Stanford, the NIH, the CDC have all been looking into this, because even if you think about 100 years ago, 1920s, we don't even have to go back further than that, people necessarily didn't eat three meals a day. They may not have had access to food. And obviously, there were certain evolutionary adaptations that allowed us to live through periods of time without food. So the question is, well, is that really the healthiest way to live? And right now, I don't think we know exactly. Now, plant-based versus animal-based, there is better data showing that plant-based proteins, for instance, are likely healthier than animal-based proteins. And what this comes down to relates to some certain amino acids and the effect of inflammation and some mortality risk. But again, the suggestion that you can't have any plant-based food and not be healthy, I don't think is 100% correct. I think that in America, we actually get a lot of protein, a lot more than we need from animal sources.
All right, Joanne, we have to take a break here, but thank you for the call. Our number is 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom of the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Med is here. We'll be back. Fox Pop, Medical Monday, Ray Graff with you at 1-800-348-2551. Joined today by Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom of the Bariatric Surgery Center at Albany Medical Center. And who's been waiting the longest? Mary in Westerlo. Mary, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about use of antidepressants and maybe other psychotropic drugs that can contribute to weight loss and how one can mitigate that problem?
The biggest and probably most consistent association is the antipsychotics with weight gain.
Yes.
Right. So things like Abilify in that category, that is very, very well known. In fact, it's so well known that if you are somebody who is on those medications, you are actually supposed to have your blood sugar and your cholesterol checked regularly, meaning anywhere from once to twice a year, because they are known to lead to hyperlipidemia, prediabetes, diabetes, and weight gain. Now, that being said, I get referrals.
My son had an issue where his levels were way off the charts, and he was on the road to fatty liver.
Yes. So fatty liver is extremely common when you have a blood sugar problem, whether that's prediabetes or diabetes. And what it relates to is the triglycerides. So when you have blood sugar problems, you typically have high blood triglycerides. The way the body tries to protect you from that is depositing the triglycerides in the liver, which is fatty liver. And again, that's the most common cause of chronic liver disease now in the United States. And we do see it in children. So, but the issue, again, you have to ask yourself, I get referrals all the time from various hospitals or patients who are on psychiatric medications. I will tell you, safety trumps weight every time. If someone needs to be on their antipsychotic to maintain their safety, there is no way I'm going to recommend coming off that medication. It's just not going to happen.
Right. But is there anything, he's not a compulsive eater, but it seems to kind of soothe and calm, and it's not compulsive, but just that the wrong kind of food groups are what he tends to go to.
Yeah, that's not a consequence of the medication itself. That's probably something more inherent to him. Some psychiatrists will put patients on metformin if they see the blood sugar starting to rise as a way to mitigate the high blood sugars, which can lead to the high triglyceride problem. So some psychiatrists will do that, although as a standard of care, it's not fully established.
All right, Mary, thanks for the call. What is it about antipsychotics that will lead to weight gain? Is it a physical thing, or is this just, as our last caller intimated, a change in
a lot of
food behavior?
Hunger.
Yeah,
it is hunger to a certain degree. And there's mechanisms that are still a bit unknown, but it's a very classic and known association. Again, there's a clear guideline that if you're on that long-term, blood sugar and cholesterol need to be monitored.
Our number here is 1-800-348-2551. Eric in Saratoga. Eric, you're up.
Hey, thank you for taking the call, Ray and Doctor. So I've got a question about my inability to keep my weight where I want it, and I'm looking for excuses, and I was wondering about my medication to control my AFib and the fact that it keeps my heart rate lower, and would that affect my metabolism at all?
So there's no medication which really affects the metabolism that dramatically. You are correct in that inability to get your heart rate up for, say, patients who are on beta blockers, that's probably one of the most classic ones. Can in theory reduce the number of calories that you're burning, but we don't see dramatic weight gain with it. One of the issues, and it's a perception issue. So, for instance, when I see a patient who comes in for even just a physical exam in primary care, and I look at their vitals and I'll look and see that maybe they gained 15 pounds in the last year. The patient is typically horrified. And I think there's this misperception that, well, the doctor must think that I've been binging or something like that. And it's really not true. So to put it in perspective, a pound is roughly 3,500 calories. So to gain a pound a year, it's actually 9 calories a day. Let's round it off to 10. Let's keep the math simple. So 15-pound weight gain a year is 150 extra calories a day, which is less than the medical definition of a snack. So part of the reason it's so easy to gain weight is that in our obesogenic environment, which America is clearly obesogenic, people have no idea necessarily what they're eating. I mean, if you go to a restaurant, some of the appetizers have 1,800 calories. So as far as the medication really making that big of an effect, I would say it's probably much smaller than you think, and it's small dietary changes that are making the effect as well.
I appreciate that. I'm dealing with that that 15 pounds that it seems to be much more difficult to get rid of it, and it comes back almost instantaneously if you don't pay attention.
Very easily in the United States, for sure.
Eric, thanks for the call. Our number is 1-800-348-2551. And Narita in Schenectady, you're on.
That's Narita?
Narita, that's you.
Okay. And my question for the doctor is, I can't eat anything solid, no meat, no seeds, no eggs, anything, no bread. But I am taking, because I love to eat, when I eat something, even fish or chicken, I eat a tablespoon of castor oil a night. I don't know if that I am doing correct. I need her advice, and if that's enough protein for me, if I drink soy milk and some quinoa.
I have to be frank. I would really recommend you talk with your provider, your primary care doctor. There are many types of pureed or less than solid diets which can be devised safely to make sure that you're getting all of your nutritional needs. Castor oil would not be recommended as a nutritional supplement. We do want to make sure you're getting an adequate carbohydrates, protein, and vitamins. So again, it might be worth a visit to your provider.
Okay. Very educational program. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom is our guest. Nick in Mechanicville. Nick, you're on.
My wife and I have a three-month-old infant, and she's trying to increase her breast milk production. And I was just wondering if the doctor may have any advice about that, besides maybe anything we might have read in books or whatnot.
I'm curious what you've tried.
So we've done some ginger and fennel tea, oat milk, and also there's a rumor that Body Armor drinks, like a coconut milk based drink, does something for it. So she's been drinking some of those.
Huh. There's not really any data for those. There is there's something called milk tea. I can't quite have the name of it, but it has some of the chamomile and things like that in it that have been shown to potentially be beneficial without being harmful. See, that's the key feature, is that are there any side effects to it? There have been some preliminary studies, interestingly enough, using metformin. Huh. But again, I would not do that without speaking to your provider.
All right. Good luck, Nick. You know, the old lady, when my wife was very young and we were having our children, the old lady said, oh, yeah, you know, Guinness Stout, one a day is going to make your milk work. Guinness Stout. She didn't like stout, so we never really tried that.
I've not heard that.
You've not heard that?
No.
And but you're a medical professional?
Exactly. I know. I'm doing them a big disservice, apparently. Who knew?
We never tried it either. All right. Jan in Middletown. Jan, you're on.
Hello. Thank you both for being there for us. Thank you, Dr. Lindstrom. Dr. Lindstrom, my husband purchased online recipes for a year for a keto diet. What is your opinion of the keto diet and what are the pros and cons? My concern is that he already has 5 stents. He's treated for high cholesterol, and I asked him to tell his doctors about his going on this diet, which he hasn't done.
So I would definitely not recommend the keto diet, particularly for someone with heart disease. So we were having this conversation earlier. Keto diet has become very popular because of a number of celebrities who are doing it right now, but I think a lot of people have misunderstandings. Keto means 70 to 80% of your calories come from fat. That's actually what keto is. Most patients who come in and tell me that they're doing keto are not actually doing keto. They're doing high protein, low carb. Keto by definition is low carb because, again, it's 80% fat. Now, the problem with low carb is that there was a study showing that low carbohydrate intake, whether that's keto, Atkins, Zone, and very high carbohydrate intake are linked with excess mortality, meaning risk of death. So there's a sweet spot for carbohydrate intake, which is roughly 50 to 55% of your calories, which again goes back to heart association, DASH, and Mediterranean diet. So for someone with heart disease, those are probably the only 3 diets I would recommend.
All righty. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thanks, Jen. 80% fat. What do you drink? Butter? Liquid butter? How do you do that?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. So if in the United States, they say that, you know, a 2,000 calorie diet is for the average person. Although, to be frank, for me, it's too many calories. I'd gain weight. But for the average person in the U.S., 2,000 is the standard when you look at labels.
Yeah.
So on keto, you'd have to get in 165 grams of fat. So to put that in perspective, you'd have to have 20 tablespoons of peanut butter to achieve that amount of fat.
I could do that.
You could do 20. That's quite a bit.
Yeah.
But again, there is, so with keto, by the way, there's some medical risk, which includes osteoporosis, kidney stones, and gout.
Ah, okay.
So yeah, there's some medical risk with keto.
Fair enough. So you don't recommend the 20 tablespoons of peanut butter a day?
I would not.
Okay.
Moderation is key.
Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom seems very sensible. She's our guest today. Renee in Campbell Hall. Renee, you're on.
I don't know. 20 tablespoons of peanut butter might be good some days.
Yeah.
But Dr. Lindstrom, I'm 63 years old. I had gained 30 pounds. I've lost it over the last 2 years by Weight Watchers. And in order to get the last 5 to 10 pounds off, I had to increase my exercise abundantly. By increasing it to 20 to 30 miles of running per week and also doing weights twice a week, I got to a point where I was seesawing up and down, and I can't quite figure out the formula for how much you're supposed to add in order to provide enough nourishment for athleticism and to lose the weight. It seems to be a chemical situation, a chemistry problem. I can't figure it out. Is there any way to figure that out?
Well, to be honest with you, we'd need much more data. If you're, you know, if you're still doing Weight Watchers, if you're logging your dietary intake, that would be beneficial. Yeah. Only because, you know, we've spoken about calories, and sometimes you'll hear people say, well, calories don't count. They do, but there's a difference. There's something called the thermic effect of food. So, for instance, Weight Watchers, talking about Weight Watchers in the 70s, Weight Watchers figured out that raw vegetables took more energy for the body to digest than cooked vegetables. So on the very original version of Weight Watchers, raw veggies were free, but cooked veggies were not. Now, as you know, Weight Watchers has gone through multiple iterations over the years. And so part of it may depend on what you're actually eating. In terms of small changes in what your body is truly absorbing caloric-wise. And that's where some dietary, long-term dietary information can be helpful. For just in general, for weight loss, diet is more important. I'm famous for a phrase, which is you can't out-exercise a bad diet unless you don't have a job and you can exercise all day. But for weight maintenance, exercise is key. So you're actually doing the right thing.
All right, Renee, thank you very much. Now quickly over to Susan in Sunderland, Mass. Susan, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if the doctor could tell us about what leafy vegetables or what, not tofu, not tempeh, not beans and rice, but what other foods actually contain protein that are of a, you know, vegetarian nature?
Well, to be honest with you, even apples contain protein, and it's a very small amount. You'd have to eat quite a bit. For non-bean foods, because we think a lot of things like chickpeas and soy, you're really, to be honest with you, you're really looking at tempeh and tofu. They're basically just processed protein from plant products. That's really all it is. It's a concentrated source.
Soybeans.
Yeah, it's a concentrated source.
But broccoli and stuff like that, does it have enough? Like you said earlier that, you know, we eat too much protein. Do we need to have protein in every meal?
You need to get a certain amount per day. The general guideline is about 10 to 15% of your calories should come from protein. So whatever it is your caloric needs are, that is the current guideline.
Okay.
Again, not all protein sources are equal in terms of how the body absorbs it. That's called bioavailability. But that information you can look up online as well.
Susan, thanks a lot. Quickly over to Carrie in Rosendale. Carrie, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Lindquist. Thanks for speaking with me. I understand that, you know, there are different quality fats and that a lot of the fats and oils that are used in commercial products have been, you know, hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated by heating them, and that makes it virtually indigestible. So I'm wondering if you know how much this is true and if that could be contributing to the fat epidemic in the American culture, if there's too much oils that have been altered so that they stay permanently good on the shelf life, but your body can't digest it properly like it would be able to a simple avocado or something.
Right. So again, not all fats are created equal. The same thing, you know, with carbs and protein. The fats that are on the shelf are actually trans fats. I think that's what you're trying to refer to when you talk about hydrogenated. They're was a federal ban that was going to be coming out. I actually don't know the status of it right now with the new administration that may have gone away.
Yeah,
trans fats. So in nutrition world, we hate to say that foods are bad, but I will tell you trans fats are truly bad. They are the one thing that are truly bad. And again, the trans fats are the ones that are on, you know, some of the pancake mixes or cake mixes that are on the shelves. But they don't label it as trans fats, and they may say hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated. So those are considered dangerous. They are pro-inflammatory, and they are risk factors for heart disease.
And aren't they in, like, things like crackers and cookies?
They can be. You have to actually look at the label. So, again, the FDA is somewhat interesting. Our FDA is far more permissible than other food regulatory programs in Europe and Canada, for instance. So for something to be labeled trans fat free, it has to have less than 0.5 grams of trans fat. So it doesn't mean it's zero.
Huh. Well, there's that little fine print there. Carrie,
yes.
We're done here. Thank you for the call. Dr. Lindstrom, how do people find out more about your program?
So we have a link on the Albany Med website. There's information also available on Facebook. And we help folks with various nutritional issues, not just surgery. Again, obesity, diabetes, things like that. We can certainly help someone and have them come in.
Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom, thank you for being here. We're just about out of time. Thanks to everybody who called in. I apologize to those folks still on the line. You can hang up now. We'll do it again. Support comes from Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. Thanks again to Dr. Jennifer Lindstrom of Albany Medical Center for being here. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowitz took the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, economist Hugh Johnson and Siena College's Aaron Pasitti join us to discuss the latest financial news and take a look at 2020. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.